buscas las ofertas de Early Black Friday en Lowe's, estás justo a tiempo. Ahorra hasta 50% en electrodomésticos selectos y hasta 25% extra en combos de electrodomésticos selectos. ¿Estás pensando ya en poner luces navideñas? Aprovecha ahorros de hasta 50% en escaleras selectas. Precios de Black Friday sin las filas de Black Friday. Lowe's, nosotros ayudamos, tú ahorras. Válido hasta el 11-19, selección varía por tienda, solo en tiendas selectas hasta agotar existencias. Detalles en Lowe's.com.
At Lowe's, this Veterans Day and every day, verified military members, veterans, and their spouses get automatic silver status in MyLowe's Rewards with free standard shipping, plus 10% off eligible purchases with no annual limit. It's one way we honor and give back to those who have served and still do. Learn more now at Lowe's.com/military. 10% discount can't be combined with another offer. Exclusions, terms, and conditions apply. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at Lowe's.com/terms. Subject to change.
Welcome back to the Beyond Broadcast podcast, a show which takes a behind-the-scenes look at industry professionals and their lives working in the broadcasting and entertainment industry. Today, I'm speaking with New Zealand director-producer Isla McLeod. Originally from Kent in the UK, Isla has a decade of experience working across the TV industry in New Zealand. Whether it be scripted, reality, and live television, Isla has been a staple of teams creating top-rated television. Her experience doesn't stop there, with Isla also taking her skills as a writer and creating her own short films, in addition to winning a nationwide funding competition with her original web series, Oddly Even. Welcome to the show, Isla, and such a pleasure to get to chat to you, mate.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Well, I should give some preamble as well, and I've said this before in many of the episodes that I've recorded with guests. Isla and I actually went to university together, to the New Zealand Broadcasting School. So it's probably been easily 10 to maybe 10 years since we've probably last spoken. At least. So it's fantastic to be able to kind of check in with you, see where you're at, but also I've been able to admire your work from afar, from obviously the years that we've not actually had conversations. So this is really cool. It's going to be a welcome return, a nice catch up. I think you were actually one of the first people I met or talked to properly when we both attended broadcasting school, oddly.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think you were one of the first people I talked to on the first day. I think we, you know how they do the learning and trust exercises where you get to know everyone and it's kind of like that. And I think we ended up getting paired up, I believe, on like the first day, which, yeah, it's great that we managed to kind of revisit this.
Did we do some trust falls? I honestly can't. That first week was such a blur because I remember being so nervous.
I think we all were. It's kind of like a first day at school scenario. It's kind of like when you're at kindergarten, trying to make friends, you know, hoping that you're wearing the cool clothes. Maybe, wearing the Thomas the Tank Engine shoes.
I definitely was not wearing the cool clothes.
Oh, mate, I don't think any of us were, to be fair. So we'll kind of go to a similar sort of field in the sense of talking about the beginnings. We had our beginning at broadcasting school in terms of our media career, but you had your beginnings over in the UK, which we touched on before obviously starting recording. And you grew up in Kent, so the UK, a bit of a far-flung place from little old New Zealand. So what was it like growing up in Kent? And how has it changed now for you, I guess, Kent? Because do you still consider it home, or is it not home at all?
No, Kent isn't home, but I always say that I'm English-born. Kiwi raised is how I describe myself because my heritage definitely straddles a lot of countries. My mother's side is originally Irish, but has been living in England for the last couple of generations. And my father's side is a couple of generations of Kiwi. And then before that, Dalmatian from Croatia and Scotland. So it's a bit of a, like everybody these days, I feel, it's a bit of a melting pot. And therefore, my accent is a bit like a mutt. It's a little bit of everything. But I lived in England until I was 9. And then I moved over here with my family. I'm one of 5 kids, so smack bang in the middle.
Jeez, that's a big family. And also a hell of a history in terms of heritage. I think you're right. I think we're all technically mutts and culture and everything else in between. And I think it's purely interesting in our situations as well with New Zealanders, because most New Zealanders are related to some far-flung, obviously, family member in some other country. And I can probably say the same. I think my heritage is Irish-Scottish, which makes sense why I'm ginger and also bald, probably.
Yes, well, I'm actually a redhead these days, but that's from a bottle, so it doesn't really count.
But you're still trying to maintain the culture in a way. I like that. You know, nothing wrong with that.
I'm just trying to get back to my roots, Jamie.
And so, 9 years old, you're moving out from the UK to this crazy land, which is New Zealand, Aotearoa. And do you remember, like, fondly your arrival in New Zealand, or was it kind of like you were packing yourself, wondering, why have my parents done this to me?
No, I remember being really excited. Definitely felt like an adventure. We'd been to New Zealand before on, you know, like family holidays to visit dad's side. So, but, you know, we'd always come in January and just gone to the beach. So I basically thought New Zealand was this, everybody lived at the beach and it was sunny all year round. And I remember we also arrived in summer. So, you know, the sort of paradise myth just perpetuated. And I remember just being really surprised that nobody was wearing shoes, because in England, like, everybody wears shoes. So I just couldn't understand where all the shoes were. I was nine, so bear with me. But I remember loving it from the get-go. And we were going to come out for a year or two. And I can still remember sitting around the family dinner table and my parents made all of us take a vote if we wanted to return to England or stay living for longer in New Zealand. And it was unanimous. We all wanted to stay. I
find that so democratic. You decided this over the dinner table between all of you. Like, I can imagine usually in those situations it would be the parents making this, but it was an actual democratic decision.
My parents are very equitable. They're lawyers by training, so everything has to be done fairly, justly, which was wonderful.
I feel like that may come up later into this conversation, because obviously the director-producer side of things definitely leans into the just balance and everything else. And so moving to New Zealand, obviously big move. And on the other end of the spectrum, probably a good thing you moved during the summer. I know of plenty of people that have moved to England, for example, during the winter, and it obviously puts them off from ever staying again.
I know the amount of people that go just in time for a Northern Hemisphere winter to kick in. And I always cringe when they're telling me, and I feel like I can't tell them, you're making a mistake. Like, that's not, that's their business and their life to decide. But yeah, there's a lot of people who have done that I know.
And I love your little mention of everyone's not wearing shoes. I actually had my partners from Argentina ask me the same thing, saying, why is there constantly memes and jokes about the fact that no one from New Zealand wears shoes? And so trying to explain that to her, when we live in quite a reasonably big city, she's like, do you not get worried about broken glass in your feet? And it's like, I don't know, it's just a normal thing. It's this odd cultural thing that we just seem to have in New Zealand, which is great.
I know, and it's totally... like now, having lived here, obviously, for the majority of my life, like I absolutely love when the weather starts getting warm enough that I don't have to be wearing shoes. Like, I'm right in it now, but it definitely took me by surprise.
And if we're moving also a little bit further forward, you were attending Maclean's College, which was the high school that you attended. I should also add some context as well that, Isla, you were living in Auckland, which is one of the biggest cities in New Zealand, but by comparison to Kent, I'm guessing, wasn't probably that big. I know Kent is not the most hugest of towns, but Auckland, by comparison, isn't really that big if you're from somewhere like the UK. So I'd love to know a little bit about your time at high school. Were you a good student? And I'm going to make the assumption that you definitely were.
Oh, I was a total nerd. I was so uncool, Jamie. But I was this sort of really weird... I don't know if you want to call it greedy or indecisive, or I couldn't decide what I wanted to do. I wanted to do everything. So I was in the accelerate stream, which takes subjects, you know, a year ahead and stuff like that. So all my nerd friends with my textbooks. But then I love drama, so I was friends with all the drama kids. I'm a terrible, to this day, a terrible actor, but I'd sort of help with the choreography and I'd be in the back of the chorus line kind of thing. I loved it, loved the energy. But my friends were the jocks. they were all, you know, and the captains of the sports teams and stuff like that. So there's this, my girlfriends tell me that I was actually called the speed walker behind my back at high school, because between periods, or, you know, between classes, I would always be charging around getting to the next sports practice or the next class, or because I wanted to do everything. I remind myself a bit of Hermione Granger with the time turner in the third Harry Potter book. I wanted to do it all. So, and I couldn't see why I couldn't.
I'm curious, do you feel like that has changed at all? Or do you feel like you're very much the same person from high school?
No, I'm
still speedwalking.
I'm still me. Yeah. I'm interested in a lot of things. I'm curious in a lot of things, and I love meeting new people. So yeah, my tastes are very varied.
Do you think even at high school, it was kind of going down that road that you're probably going to be in some sort of position or working a job that involved a little bit of that, of being able to be hot on your toes all the time, thinking fast, doing things fast, but on top of that, being good at networking? Because the role that you've taken later in life does require most of those skills.
And looking at it now, I can definitely see the parallel. But I honestly thought in high school that if you're a female and good at English, you're just told to be a lawyer. That's like the only careers advice that you ever receive. And I actually had a scholarship at the end of high school to go to Vic Uni in Wellington and do a law degree. And my mum pulled me aside, who was, I think if you remember, trained as a lawyer, and she's an incredibly smart woman. And she said, I think if you took that scholarship, you'd be making a terrible mistake. I don't think you'd enjoy a career in law. Like, you might be fine at it, but I don't actually think it would fulfill your interests. So then I really went to square zero. At one point, I really was really interested in flight air traffic control. That's still my
plan. That's very left field.
Media doesn't work out. I'm going to do that. It's always excited me. I considered the police, I think, for a bit. Like, I really wasn't sure what I was going to do.
Do you feel that's also from the eye of your creative mind? Because you've studied, like, as you said, you did a lot of different things. You were across multiple different sort of subject matters, like theatre, sports, everything else between. Do you feel like that's the creative side of your mind, where it's like the indecisiveness is also what also makes you you, because you also able to compartmentalize that into organization as well? Because it's not like you weren't achieving these things. It's not like you were doing a bad job of all these various things you're involved with. You're still doing a good job. You were just trying to kind of figure things out.
Yes. And I think I'm not very good at projection. And when I use that word, I mean like when I go shopping, for instance, I cannot online shop for the life of me. And even when I'm in the shop, I take like 60 things off the hangers. The shop assistants honestly detest me. I'm their worst nightmare. And then I try all these things on and only one thing I actually like. Like, but when I've tried it on and I'm wearing it, I know exactly if I like it or not. But I'm not very good at telling if I'll like something, which is why I think I have to do everything myself, because it's only when I'm immersed in something then I know immediately if it's for me or if I want to continue it. Or does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And I think it's interesting because you've also had a lot of these opportunities in the way of scholarships. Like, you mentioned that you had a legal scholarship to go study at Vic, but then on top of that as well, you had the opportunity with a Shakespeare Globe Centre where you got sent to the UK. Like, you won this award. Mm. And so you have so many of these opportunities. Like, yeah, was it not hard to kind of think, like, how do I choose when I'm being offered all these opportunities? How do I make the distinction? And then how did that end up being, I'm going to go to New Zealand Broadcasting School? How did that decision come about after having so many doors open for you?
It was that same conversation with my mum. She just said, she's so smart and she knows her children very well. And she's guided a lot of us in terms of not telling us what she thinks we should do, but just having conversations with us to, like, talk about what kind of interests we have and what kind of life we want to lead. And okay, well, that could mean a career in this or a career in that. And she's the one who suggested, among some other things, broadcasting school. And I liked that it was the only media training in New Zealand where you actually come out with a degree, you know, not a certificate or a diploma. So I liked that aspect. And I also, my family has a rule that we do not stay at home for university. We do not stay in our home city. My parents had this strong belief that at that age, the learning that you can receive from relocating and setting down roots somewhere new, not having a support system immediately there, like being forced to make new friends and meet new types of people that you've probably not been exposed to before, you know, because you're under 18 and living at home and being sheltered. That kind of learning is so important for a human. So basically, I couldn't stay in Auckland. So the fact that it was in the South Island was really appealing. I think the South Island is so beautiful, and it's where my Kiwi family live.
On the job, every minute counts. That's why Lowe's now has ProBlock Quick Dry Primer, expertly manufactured by Sherwin-Williams. Engineered for pros to dry fast and go on smooth for virtually flawless results that keep your job moving. It's available in oil and water-based, and getting it is easy. Order online by 2 p.m. and get free same-day delivery right to your job site. Lowe's, we help, you save. Orders placed after 2 p.m. will be delivered next day. Valid in select zip codes, subject to driver availability. More terms apply.
If? And so I have, like, not in Christchurch, they live in Queenstown, but I have a really strong affinity to the South Island. So, and then that basically sold the deal, to be honest. I don't remember thinking about it a lot. I just sort of assumed, sounds fun, we'll all work out.
So there was no preamble thought of, this is going to be the career that I take, this is going to be the thing that I'm going to be doing for, like, foreseeable future. It was kind of like a, this could be interesting to do. Let's see where the journey goes, and whatever happens, happens. There was no real, like, this is the definitive thing.
No, and I remember
that's like interesting
that conversation that I had with my mum, and I was like, "Yep, okay, I'm going to apply for B-School." We then realized applications were like closing that week or something, so I had to like rush it all together.
That's impressive, and. If you were to look back at any pivotal moment in you making the decision, aside from the conversation that you had with your mum, was there any sort of inspiration for you to move into television or film? Was there like a particular film or a TV or someone, an industry that you feel like really inspired you to get involved?
No, it was always the scratch I couldn't itch. My family didn't have a TV when we were growing up. My dad thought it would rot our brains. So we had bookshelf after bookshelf of books. And like we all played lots of sport and did lots of sort of, you know, I'm a dancer by training. So lots of sort of cultural activities. My siblings all played instruments. They gave up with me because me and the piano didn't work out. But yeah, we all did lots of stuff. I never felt like something was missing. But obviously, I would go to friends' houses or go to the movies, and I would just absolutely relish the TV shows or the films. And it was this thing that because it was never at the edge of my, you know, fingertips, it was something that was a real treat that I really looked forward to.
So it was more than just, because I think growing up for a lot of people, television and film is obviously a very everyday thing. So for you, it was an experience going to the cinema. It was an experience you sitting down and watching an episode of something. Do you feel like it, even now you have more appreciation for the craft just based on that because you didn't grow up with it as just this common
so
thing?
Much. I still feel guilty to this day. If I've ever got a rare day off and I want to, like, all I want to do is close the blinds and put a movie on in the middle of the afternoon. And if I ever do that, and it happens rarely, but it does happen, I feel really guilty. I feel like, who am I to be watching TV in my home? What an absolute shit.
I think that's really interesting because I feel like there'd be a lot of other people that would have the exact opposite opinion of that. So I think that's just a credit to you, really, if anything. And so we're going to broadcasting school, first day, first year. What were your feelings like when you arrived? How did you feel about your decision? Did you, because as you said, it was your parents' decision, and also kind of like a family kind of thing that you have to go away from home, you need to relocate, have no support system. You've gone into an industry that you've said, you know what, I want to give this a go, see what happens. How was that for you being in that environment? Because you're kind of just thrown into the deep end, really.
No, it was really tough. I'd never had to work to make friends before in my life. Not because I've never been, you know, this super popular person. It's just that, like I said, I did so many things. You naturally meet so many people and you're playing in a netball team for months of the year. Like, it was just easy to meet people. But then when I moved to Christchurch, I did not have a car, which was a definite. If I could go back in time, I would definitely have brought a car down. But that didn't matter anyway because I didn't have my license. So that's wishful thinking. Couldn't get around the city, wasn't familiar with the city. It was immediately after the earthquakes. So I basically lived in a student residential hall that was just surrounded by rubble, literally, and cones. There was no kind of nightlife. And you know this, Jamie, like our broadcasting school is competitive to get into and they only take so many students. So it wasn't like going to uni and there being like a big orientation week, mixers, and, you know, where the whole purpose is for you to sort of meet people. That didn't exist. There was no kind of nightlife or things going on in Christchurch. A lot of cultural stuff, exhibitions, festivals had obviously been put on hiatus because of the earthquake or moved to outside the CBD. And although I was really enjoying the university, it was, the really small classes. And I think you'll remember this, Jamie, there was very little interaction between the streams of TV, radio, and journalism socially. Like, there was no opportunity, there was no shared common room or anything like that. So I was fucking lonely in the first 6 months. I was flatting with strangers, and very far away from everybody that I knew. And I remember being really down about it because a lot of my friends had also left uni, had also gone to different, you know, universities around the country. But they were having an absolute whale of a time. They made heaps of friends immediately and were doing a lot of drinking and having a lot of fun. And I remember being incredibly homesick.
I can understand that. Even though I was obviously studying in my hometown, Christchurch being my hometown, so for me it was not a far-flung place. But for anyone else that was coming into that scenario, I can't really imagine what it would have been like, much like what you touched on. The city was destroyed, so socializing for the most part was very restricted in terms of what was available and what there was to do. But I definitely noticed that even with, as you also mentioned, there was almost like an air of competitiveness between the streams. I haven't touched on this with other guests that I've had on the podcast, but yeah, New Zealand Broadcasting School very much, I don't think by intention, but it became separated and competitive in a sense. Like, the journalists wouldn't talk to the radio people.
Shame.
Or the radio people wouldn't talk to the television people. It was split apart during the beginning.
The stereotype that we had was that the TV kids were the nerds.
Yeah.
The journos were like the preppy, debating captains, head prefects, and the radios were the cool kids. And there was just no mixing. And it's so strange because now, 10 years out from broadcasting school, the majority of my friends that I've kept in contact with, kept crossing paths with, sometimes had the opportunity to work with, haven't been the people from my TV class. They've been from the other streams. And I'm like, that should not. I literally spent the weekend with one of your radio compatriots, Chris Goodyear. Like, I do it the most brilliant. Wonderful man. Like, and that wasn't. Yeah, I definitely think there's more opportunity at that school for cross-stream, especially with the media landscape. The borders between the micro-industries are completely disintegrating. So I don't understand why the learning institutions aren't leaning into that.
And we're certainly going to touch on that more and later down the track of our chat, because I couldn't agree more with you. And it's interesting that I feel that was definitely the case, as you said, during that first year, there was a little bit of blending towards the end, but I would say it's pretty accurate to what you're saying now. And funnily enough, I agree with you on the point as well that, yeah, most of the people that I've met later down the track, especially post university, post broadcasting school, well, yeah, we're out from the other streams. I keep in contact with a lot of the old journalists that maybe at the other time we wouldn't have talked, or they probably would have thought I was a prick. One of the two, you know.
Nobody would have thought you were a prick, Jamie. You were always so friendly.
As were you. And I don't know why. I don't know why the television people didn't connect with the radios as much. It was odd. It was a very odd time, and so I can understand the homesickness, the difficulty of that first couple of months. And moving through, you obviously got to a point where you were starting to feel more comfortable. You're connecting with a lot of people, and when you're getting to that first year period of broadcasting, you're starting to also come into your own and realize where you're going to be. And at what point do you feel you came to this sort of realization, oh, I want to be in directing and producing? Was there a particular marking point to that, or do you feel it was something that gradually just happened anyway?
No, I'd come in with that as the goal, because I'd done a bit of directing at high school and really enjoyed it. Only theatre. Actually, no, I took media in year 13 and directed this awful, awful short film that I'm pretty sure it won an award for being terrible, which should not be an award that they give out at like the student film awards. Like, I think it's so negative. Yeah, I'm pretty sure I won the award. It's called the Wooden Spoon, and it's for bad, being a bad. So, that's what I was coming in with. So obviously from that, I was like, this is it, guys. This is meant to be. So I always wanted to do the directing. And then I think I got a bit intimidated because, 80% of the TV class all wanted to be directors, and we got told a lot, which I don't think is the wrong thing to be telling students. But we did get told a lot, like, a large scale film in New Zealand, like big, big scale domestic film would have a crew of a couple of hundred people. There will be one director. Like, there is so many interesting departments to work in film and TV. There's, there's scripted, there's documentary, there's reality. Like, there's so many avenues you can go. Directing is an incredibly niche avenue, and it's very, very hard to get into and to forge a career out of. So I think they were just being realistic. But basically, I got told like every week, like, think again. But it was just always this voice in the back of my mind, but it's what I want to do.
Do you think in that same respect, it almost lit a fire in you of being like, I will show you I can do this? Because it's I feel like that's always the case with a lot of people. If you get told you're not going to be able to do something, you can't do something, you're going to do the exact opposite. You're going to try and do it, or at least give it a go. Do you feel that sort of same
Jamie,
pressure?
I feel like people like me and you, that it does. It definitely does light the fire. And I'm stubborn as hell. So, I probably did just double down from it, which probably has helped, right, long term, because they were absolutely right about everything. It is a fucking, pardon my French, hard career. And you have to be incredibly resilient to keep plodding on. So, like, it was all good prep, basically.
Yeah, I agree with you. If I'm looking back at what happened to me during uni, I was basically told at one point, don't even try to do voice or hosting, which I didn't even want to do anyway. And then randomly, I fell into it to the point that even when I went to the UK to work in radio, I was still getting told to go on air, which was the complete opposite of what they were telling us during our time at broadcasting school. They said, don't expect that you're going to be on the microphone. I don't expect you're going to be doing this. You're more than likely going to be some background or extra in the story that is your life of radio. You're probably going to be working behind the scenes, which is good because I enjoyed that. But then it's funny how sometimes when you're told so many times that this isn't going to happen, it happens to you anyway through, as you said, stubbornness, tenacity, or being able to stick it out. And would you say that can be a big part of being in the industry in a way, is that you do have to be tenacious? Because
absolutely.
Do you feel like a lot of people drop out for that, knowing that like it is quite a hard industry to be in?
No, so much so. And I've been told by several people, or several people have observed to me, that it's often just like the people left standing at the end that end up, getting the opportunities. Like, there's a lovely and very successful actor, male actor in his 60s, who I won't name, but I've worked with him on a few jobs now. And he's so warm. And, you know, the jobs that I've worked with him on, I have been like a very lowly crew person. And he's been a lead, but he will still be kind, which I think is just the mark of his character. And he told me, we got talking once in a quiet moment on set. And he was like, I honestly think my success is down to the fact that I just kept going. And there's now just not a lot of men in their 60s who look like me who are acting. So, like, I don't have a lot of competition. Like, he was really frank and pragmatic about it. And he's a wonderful actor. But he's also just done the most amount of time on the blocks, right?
I think that's a really good point because, yeah, especially now, it's I've met some veterans in TV, radio, and film, and I feel like they echo the very much the same thing. And it's almost very accurate as well to a conversation I had earlier on one of the first episodes that I recorded, where Ryan Foster, who worked for MyFM, talked about the fact that there is a lot of it as being prepared for that right moment. It's not saying that 100%. There is not hard work involved, but it is also the right moment. And being there is the right moment. Yeah, there's a lot of hard work involved, but there might be an element of luck or chance, or you just having the right person on set on the day who says, you know what, like, I need you again, or I want to work with you. And from that, I kind of want to move into talking about your first role post-broadcasting school, because that is an element of at university, of that degree, of that study, is getting that internship, that first role. And do you mind telling me a little bit about that first role? What was it? How did that conversation happen?
I was the wardrobe runner for X Factor. And for those of you listening from New Zealand, this is the infamous X Factor season, where two of the judges caused an absolutely viral moment in like a quarterfinal for bullying a contestant during the show, got fired. It was this whole drama filled. It was wonderful to be a part of as like a small, lowly, nobody cares about me and I can just absorb everything that's going on. But how it came about was the producer of one of the producers of the show, who is an incredible producer, who I'm still in touch with. She needed a heap of interns for the season, came down to B school, and she just interviewed the whole TV class, basically. The only prerequisite was you needed to have a driver's license. In the film industry, you cannot get your first job if you do not have a full driver's license. It is the most important thing, regardless of where you studied, who your connections are. In every single department, your first job will be running to some degree, doing errands, which is an essential role that's required on every production, and there's usually multiple runners, hence needing the driver's license to be able to ferry around cast or producers or whatever's required. I still did not have my license. I was lazy, wasn't getting onto it, and so I realized, oh, I wouldn't be able to be interviewed. And everyone in the class was so excited. You know, this was clearly going to be the big, juicy internships that everyone was going to compete for. So it's a bit embarrassing that I'm admitting this on tape, but I lied. I lied and said that I had my driver's license. Like, I ticked the little box because I was thinking about it and I was like, this is the exact kind of internship that I want. If I interview and they don't choose me because of the interview, they're like, you're not the most promising candidate, then at least I've had a chance. If I do get through the interview, then I will email them and say, I don't have a license. Will you still take me? And if you won't, I completely understand. I lied. It's my fault.
I think that's a very good move.
And they came back with, look, I'm sorry, we loved you. We had offered you it, but you don't have a driver's license. So sorry, no. And I was like, completely fair enough. At least I know that I've got one more interview under my belt. And that was good, like, learning practice. So they gave the internships to other people in my class, all well-deserving. I was a bit down in the dumps and I was struggling to find another internship and feeling a bit sorry for myself, because I was too lazy to have sorted out my driver's license when I had plenty of time to do so. up until this moment, which again is Ryan's point, right? Like, you'll never know when that moment will come and you've got to be ready. You've got to have done the work before. It's too late in that moment to start now needing to prep for it. You've got to always be on your toes. Anyway, and then I, complete stroke of luck, the producer rang me back and said, I have thought about you since and I would like to offer you an internship because the wardrobe, the costume supervisor, which is a massive job on a show like that with that amount of talent to dress, and every time you see them, they're in a new outfit, new accessories, the whole shebang. She would like a runner this season, which we found money for. And because you'll be carting around clothing and jewelry and shoes, you'd be fine on your restricted license. Could you get your restricted license in the next 2 months? And I was like, absolutely, hell or high water, I will be there. So I did the internship on my restrictors, which worked fine. And such a tough internship. The opportunity, like the show was incredible, the credit on my CV, the connection with that producer, all of that has been incredibly helpful in my career. But working in that department was so difficult.
Have you done anything that's been anywhere near as stressful as that? I've done production running myself, and I can attest to anyone who has not cut their teeth doing that, that I don't think you've worked in industry until you've done a running job. Like, yeah, do you think that's been the most difficult job you've ever done?
Honestly, one of the most. I can think of a couple of one other which was difficult, but that was for a completely different reason. Your running is so hard. You are basically having to be a mind reader while you don't know what you don't know. But at this stage in your career, you know fucking nothing.
Yeah.
You know nothing. Mm-hmm. I made mistake after mistake. The costume supervisor was very technically talented and very well connected to the industry, but quite a difficult personality. I remember crying a lot because I could tell how badly I was like fucking it up. I'm sorry that I'm saying swearing so much. I do swear. So
no,
here we go.
It's okay. Uncensored
version. Like, it was such a steep learning curve. I'm so grateful for it, but it was an absolute shitter of a time in the moment.
Because the other thing that we get warned about a lot earlier on in our careers is, I guess a lot of mentors or older people always say, you're probably going to have that moment that you contemplate leaving the industry, or you're basically at breaking point and you're about to cry and you lose it. I can certainly think of multiple moments where I've had that, and actually running was one of the scenarios where I had a complete mental breakdown after a day and was like, why am I even doing this? Like, why do I choose to put myself through this? But yeah, at the end of the day, you need it.
Yeah, it's an essential role. And you're paid like absolute minimum wage, less than that, if they can get away with it. Like, it's so thankless. I really don't like how the industry does not have any respect for runners. Like, because they're an essential role. And yes, they're at the bottom of the pecking order, but they're still essential.
I think a point that we could touch on as well is that it is almost an expectation for everyone at some point, especially in television and film, that they have to go through that role.
Do you've got to do the trial by fire.
And do you think that is a good way to run industry in a sense? It kind of reminds me of the idea of how you hear of people that get into culinary, like getting into the kitchen. You start by washing the dishes and then you move up.
Yeah.
Do you think that is a good way for an industry to run? Obviously, aside from the negatives, which is the money's crap, the work conditions are not always the greatest. I certainly do feel it's nice to have that in an industry where you don't feel people have just been given a chance. You kind of still have to prove yourself.
I do subscribe to the notion that it's a healthy way to build up the industry, right? Because that manual labor, that sort of grunt work, needs to happen. Those roles need to be filled, and it's a trade exchange, right? Your manual labor for their knowledge, because the industry itself. And I don't think this is bespoke to the media industry. I have a lot of, the majority of my friends, older friends, don't work in the industry. They work across healthcare or tech or anything like that. And they've all echoed my sentiment that for all the training that we did in the tertiary institution, it's entirely different when you're on the job. And there's this whole other learning on the job where you're like, fuck, you need to not prepare me for this at all. Yeah. And that is what's happening when you're running or you're a PA or you're an assistant or trainee. You're just getting coffees and doing the grocery shop for unit and dropping off drives. But you are, I was just constantly listening. You're in the room, you're watching, you're observing the dynamics, you're figuring out, okay, that department does that. They're the boss of them, but they seem to have some kind of influence. It's like, you know, being a new little gorilla or chimp, you know, that's joined a new, I don't know what the word is for a group of monkeys, a pride, a...
We'll make the assumption it's something like that.
You know what I mean? Like there's so much social and EQ absorption that's going on at that point that you cannot get that kind of training and experience if you're not working on those productions. And to get your foot in the door, you just have to do your time as a grunt.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's an important step. While you're completely right that maybe some things do need to change in industry, it is an important part. And just to kind of backpedal a little bit, when you were talking about the X Factor big debacle drama, was that the Willie Moon Natalia Kills thing? Oh,
yes. And I remember we were in this huge studio. As much as the running was stressful and my boss was a bit of a dragon and all this stuff, I didn't once second guess my choice of industry. The magic of a set has always been entirely intoxicating to me. That sheer number of people all working together, all bringing completely different skill sets for one goal just always gets me going. I love it. I fucking love it. And so I was on this huge studio out in South Auckland, this warehouse thing that we were using golf carts to drive around inside the studio. It was that big. And I remember the US, you know, the network EPs flying in to deal with this crisis. And oh yeah, it was so much drama. By the way, a group of chimpanzees is called a troop, which I love.
Which is very fitting because I feel like you do very need to be fitting. Kind of like a squadron, a unit when you're working in television.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Because anything could go wrong at any moment. That being a perfect example of it. And so do you feel you still get that same feeling of that first time on set, even now?
Yeah, I do.
That's not, beautiful.
Not to a huge degree if it's like a small, you know, a baby set with staff, because obviously I've spent a lot of time on set now, you know, 10, 12 years later. But the big jobs, I still do. I've recently been just helping out, not part of the main unit, but doing a few days on a big Netflix TV series that's shooting over here that has proper money and has proper scale. And it is incredible walking onto a set like that. The amount of the work that the art department has done is art. They've created an entire world that you get to play around in for the day and make look good and tell a story. And like, I'm still amazed that this industry works. You basically get paid to like play and tell stories.
And speaking of telling stories, after New Zealand Broadcasting School and after this first, these first roles that you had in television and film, you went on to do screenwriting at Vic Uni, at Victoria University. What made you make that decision after you've immediately studied to then go back to studying again? Like, I think some people would say that's a definition of insanity, but what made you want to go back into that area? Because it's still, obviously, it's adjacent and incredibly useful, but what made you want to go straight into screenwriting after already going through this whole process of studying, getting your first roles
Well, I had, I'd learned heaps at broadcasting school and it does have a really good, thought process of we'll make sure everyone does everything so you've got an understanding, which I totally agree with. Like, you do need to be able to understand what other departments in the industry are doing. Even if you never want to work as a sound designer, it's still really helpful to, you know, do sound on a few friends' films so you understand what it takes. So you sort of did lots of everything, but you only really got to specialize right at the very end. And that basically meant you got to make one short film and you could do on that short film the role that you wanted to. And so that just wasn't enough training for me. I still felt really raw and underdeveloped. So I'd had a year in between, like I'd finished my internship, done a few other jobs. I'd gone to France for a bit because I speak French. So I'd gone and taken some language exams. And then I was looking around for where else I could be in an environment that would support me and let me train a bit further in a specifically a creative role. I felt like I'd done my foundational technical stuff. I wanted to be specifically creative. And Vic Uni has had an amazing creative writing program for screenwriters, novelists, and playwrights. I think they also do poetry now, actually, as well. And at the time, it was run by this wonderful man, Ken Duncan, who is such an incredible teacher. And I was in Welly visiting some friends, and I asked to meet him for coffee. I just asked about the course, what could I expect? Because I was basically like, do I want to give up, you know, another year of my life, add to my student loan, blah, 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 to do this. But from that 40-minute conversation with him, I walked out and I was like, this is exactly where I want to be. So then it was a whole other process of putting together an application and interviewing and blah, blah, blah. And Ken did say to me at the time, he said, you're a lot younger than the students, because it's a master's, right? So it's the average age would probably be mid-30s, and I am now 21. And he was like, I think you would get a lot more out of this course if you came later in life. And me being stubborn and me being like, no, I want to do everything now, all the time, let's do it all. I was like, no, it's got to be now, Ken, it's got to be now. And I sort of twisted his arm into letting me in. And I think he was completely right. I do think I would have got more out of the course having come later. However, I wouldn't be where I am today if I hadn't done the course then. So, I mean, I'll never know, right? But it was a wonderful year of learning and growth. And it always felt like to me like a really natural progression from B school. That I'm surprised more people haven't done that route. If you want to be a writer or a director, why not? You know, do it, because most people's degrees are 3 to 4 years. Ours was 2 and a bit. So it felt like a normal amount of time. All my other friends were, you know, finishing off their degrees anyway. I don't feel like I, you know, was suffering going back to studying. I felt like I was just finishing it off.
Yeah, and that's right. Because of the fact that it is shorter, it does kind of open the door for you to be able to take a little bit more time to think about things. Because I look back on that time as well and think, I was really young when I entered the industry, and I'm sure you probably had the same thought as well, that if you look at the peers that you have working next to you, generally they're going to have a couple of years on you. I definitely know that was the case for me in the UK when I went and was in a position where some of the guys were 5-6 years older than me, but in some respects I was having to kind of be the lead there, because we just get thrown into the industry and told like, here you go, like, have fun, enjoy. Whereas a lot of other guys have come out, yeah, after 4 or 5 years having studied and maybe have only just started going on their journey. So it does make sense that you decide to do the writing. And it kind of led to a quite a good thing, because not long after you did that, you won a shorts competition. And this was like, I'm guessing what, a year after you finished that master's?
Yes. And I remember putting so many lessons I'd learned at Institute of Modern Letters into practice. We put some of the money towards Ken mentoring us a little bit during the scripting process. And the kind of man that he was refusing to take the money. And we were like, you must. Like, you've... Yeah, that was one of the better decisions we did. It was one of the very few examples we did of building some support around ourselves. Because the funding competition, I co-created a series with a really good friend. So the whole thing was we co-directed it, co-created it, co-wrote it. But we didn't put a lot of support around ourselves, which was the big learning of the series.
And in terms of, it was your first big project that was self-directed, self-produced. As you said, it was co-created with another friend of yours who I think was also a fellow student at broadcasting school as well. Is that right?
Yeah, he was. We'd been in the same TV class, had so much of a taste overlap. I had a real wonderful creative chemistry, and she's still a really good friend to this day. She's a wonderful lady.
And in terms of the process itself, what do you think was the biggest hurdle or obstacle that you learned from working on one, your own original series, which in itself kind of must be a little bit scary. I know you'd obviously, I think you'd done a pilot as well as part of this pitching process, right, for the funding competition. Did you find it scary? Was it kind of a little bit terrifying to have the reins passed over to you and be like, we have to do this now. We've made this. We've won this funding. What do we do now?
Absolutely terrified. Ash called me, who's the friend, the co-creator, when I was still in Welly. She'd seen, you know, the press about it. And she was like, we should make a pilot. We should enter this competition. And the pilot was just fun. Like, we made it with our B-School friends, with actor friends that we knew. Like, I remember just enjoying myself. And then we won the vote, so we got the funding, and Ash got the official like phone call or email, and she called me to give me the news, and she was so excited. She was like frothing at the mouth over the phone. And I remember I was walking on a street in Auckland, and I remember my stomach dropping. I remember being absolutely terrified, like, oh God, we now actually have to do it. I said I wasn't good at projection. I hadn't actually thought about the possibility of what actually happens if we have to do it. Ironic. But we did.
Yeah, you did, and it did very well. And I think it was the start of what would become like a very regular thing for the funding competition being associated with New Zealand On Air, that they started putting more and more money into online series, which is great because it was an emerging area. You guys were probably one of the first ones to start doing original online series through New Zealand. How does it feel now looking back and seeing obviously the result?
Well, there was definitely, it was sort of that golden era of web series for sure, but I actually think we were on the tail end. There was a couple of really exciting series that weren't cooked up out of any competition, were literally just makers off their own bat creating some awesome stories. And I think TVNZ saw that trend and just wanted to tap onto it. And then, of course, it then grew into this like whole tidal wave of digital series. And also with traditional like TV breaking down with streamers, like it's all sort of now become one big melting pot. And I love a digital-led series because there's no... because of the freedom in terms of durations, the story can be told. The story can be as long as the story needs to be. And that obviously gives you a lot more freedom creatively to actually fit the story to the shoe that actually fits it. But the experience itself was, you know, how earlier in this session I said there was two jobs which had been the hardest in my life. And the first being the running one, for sheer being... we call it in the industry being green. When you're new and you know nothing and you're making mistakes, you're called a green or a greenie. First job being bad for that reason. And the second job was the web series. We were just alone with money, and we made the classic error of trying to make too much for the budget that we had. And nobody made us do that. I want to be really clear, like, I think then I'm pretty sure the network commissioner was like, are you sure you want to make this many number of episodes? Like 100K really doesn't go very far in TV, like very far at all. And I know it seems like a lot of money to people, but TV and film is very expensive. It involves a lot of people, a lot of days and a lot of gear. And that stuff just, it adds up. And then you add in all the things that you need for on camera. So, you know, your art and your costumes and your story requisite. And we had a massive ensemble cast and loads of storylines. And me and Ash were like, you know, we were hungry and we were ambitious and we weren't taking no for an answer. And we completely shot ourselves in the foot. It was incredibly, incredibly difficult experience. And that has been the closest I've ever been to walking away from the industry.
That's really interesting because it's the first time you've been given the creative reins and you're trying to make something work based on the budgets that you have, which, as you said, are very tight, big ambitions. Do you think it was almost like the pressure was put on yourself more than obviously the expectation of the funding agency and the people with NZ On Air? Do you feel it was more yourself and Ash were kind of building up this pressure because you wanted to make this perfect product? Do you think that can also be maybe a bit of the producer director side of you, the perfectionism of trying to achieve something that you really want to achieve.
Yes. We basically were like, right, we would have been, maybe we're 22 by this point, 21, 22. And we're like, right, this is it. This is our career, like, made. Like, we're going to go viral with this. It's going to be the best web series anybody's ever seen. And surprise, surprise, it wasn't. Like, we had wonderful crew, really wonderful cast. And me and Ash have talked about this very frankly since and are on completely the same page. We made a good little web series. Not offensive. But it wasn't going to win any awards. It wasn't going to change people's lives. Like, none of those things. And of course it wasn't. That is like Picasso expecting, to create his masterpiece on his second attempt pulling out of a canvas. Like, but yeah, it was, we just, between me and Ash, we covered like 17 roles to try and, stretch the budget further. We did not sleep for months on end, no break. We didn't pay ourselves during the whole endeavor. And we were just very lucky that we're both from Auckland. So we could remain living with our parents, and they took pity on us and didn't make us pay rent for the period. We just completely burnt ourselves out and tied ourselves into knots, and then ended up with a product that, was never going to be our best work that we make in our careers. If I'm peaking at 22, that's not where I want to be. And so after it, I was so burnt out. I basically took a couple of years off. I really reconsidered leaving the industry. I did a whole heap of travel. I didn't touch anything creative. I couldn't even go near a project in terms of, I just kind of needed a lot of time to heal afterwards.
So where did Healing Isla go during that period? As you said, you did some traveling, but you were still in industry, weren't you? You were doing stuff on the production side of things, like New Zealand Music Awards. You were doing these massive live events.
Yes, all of them from a production capacity. I was lucky, a few contacts I'd made before the web series from, when I'd been like PA, those jobs obviously continued, and people needed slowly moved up in terms of production, like becoming a junior coordinator, running. There was a really cushy job that I had for at least a year where I was a commissioner's assistant. So you're basically just a glorified secretary. It was very chill, and it's the only job I've ever had to this day where I had a salary. And I had public holidays, Jamie. Oh my God, I had a year of paid public holidays. I still miss those. And I didn't have to use any part of my creative brain. I just had to turn up, do what I was told, pocket my money, and I just focused on my friends and my hobbies and, traveling. I went and all around Europe and did a bit of South America. I focused on other aspects of my life for literally a couple of years because I couldn't, it had burned me out to that capacity. Because if this is something that is like your dream and what you want to do, and you know how hard it is to be given these opportunities to be a director or a showrunner, and then you're handed this opportunity at 21, and then you don't fulfill what you wanted. I seriously questioned whether I was in the right direction, and maybe I didn't have any prospects in this career.
I feel like that very much mirrors something I kind of had around the same age as you, around 23, 24, where I made this big decision to move over to the UK, and I had these big expectations on what was going to happen next. And when it didn't fall through, I did a similar thing, took the break period. I'll be honest, I was a gardener in West London. I completely dropped out of everything media related, and I had to have healing time as well. And I think it's not uncommon in the industry. I think a lot of people do get to burnout, whether it be the long hours or maybe, the dreams that they feel like they're not quite hitting in some regard. But it's a testament to you that you decided afterwards, you're like, no, I need to stay in this industry. I know there's something there for me. I know it's going to keep going, because you stayed and then you moved into scripted TV as well, which, do you feel that was important?
But the thing is that that doubt or that questioning or that impatience that, you know, you're not progressing at the rate you'd like to, I honestly think is the cost. Mm. It is part and parcel of this industry and this career choice. And that was the lesson that I was learning and what everyone in our industry learns, especially with a creative endeavor. There is very, very, very few people who just get to do their dream job after dream job, like, you know, back up, you know, straight after each other. That for the vast majority of us who are lucky enough and work hard enough to forge a career in this industry, it's actually very ebb and flow. There's periods where you're a lead and you're creatively dipping into that well and you're taking charge on a project. And then you can supplement your lifestyle with working for other people where the responsibility isn't yours, where you can recharge that well, heal, focus, and then you're strengthened again. Like, I think of the work as very seasonal. It's very project-based. It's not steady. It's going to come in like spurts, and there will be quiet, low periods. And it is, again, going back to our discussion about resilience, it's all about who can just weather the storm. Weather the storm, know that it's going to pass, know that there'll be a next chapter, a next evolution, who can keep pivoting. I honestly think that's the lesson that I needed to learn. And it was a painful one, but I'd rather have learned it at 22 than at 45.
100%. Do you feel you've taken these same learnings yourself and applied them? Because I'm sure you've worked with people young, wet behind the ears in the industry who have just entered. Have you been that kind of voice of reason to them to tell them, like, hey, this is how it is, but in the same respect, if you stick it out, you are going to enjoy it. Like, trust me, the suffering maybe you're having at this moment, it will pass, and then you'll go back to loving this and, like, understanding why you got into this industry.
No, I've definitely had a few sort of, you know, like, my godmother has texted me and been like, my neighbor's daughter wants to get into film. Can you take her out for a coffee? And I've done that, and I've, like, ruined the poor girl because I've been like, look, this is what's ahead of you. I want you to be prepared. Like, I don't know if she's at the industry. But, like, and I'm like, it's not all doom and gloom. The, you know, the fruits of the labor are incredible, and I believe worth it. But you have to do what you have to do to figure out if you're willing to put in that amount of work. And I don't want to say that I have all the answers and I've figured that out myself, because I haven't. I still have the storms. I am still having the quiet periods. I'm still having the doubt. I'm just getting a little bit better at accepting that that is going to be my future.
Love that. I think that's really beautiful. And as you said, it's a project by project basis. You're kind of always wondering where the next job is, but in the same respect, it's, you know, that's the industry. You know, something will come along. And I'm curious about this because I feel like
I'm eternally optimistic.
Yeah. Like,
maybe some people call that naive, but that's just the way that I rumble. And I remember at B school, I was just so perplexed. I didn't understand this freelance business. Like, what do you mean people don't know what they're doing next and they just wait for the phone call? What do you mean you'll never go for a job interview in your life? Like, I really did not understand that concept, because when you're a child and when you're at school, like, you know, the only careers that you're ever showcased, like, no one ever learns about what it is to be a contractor in high school, which they should learn. They should teach that.
100%.
And tax law is what they should teach us for. But I didn't understand it. But I know now that, like, and then I can't remember who said it to me. I wish I could. Said, if you have a good attitude and you're adequate at your job, just trust that there will be work. But I love that they said that they said attitude first. Because the thing is that the industry does exist. 99% of people are freelancers. They do make it work. Things do come up. Definitely save for a rainy day to get you through the patches in between. But if you have got a good attitude and, you know, you make sure you can do the job, then you will get work.
That I can attest to that as well. And it's similar advice that I was once told, and I think it's the best advice I've ever been given, was if you're walking into any area in production, TV, anything at all, and I remember this exclusively from working in a studio once and walking in with a CV, that I greeted the person that was working admin behind the desk, and the best advice I ever heard was someone was, always be kind to the admin person, because I can guarantee they're going to be the person that will get you the job. And lo and behold, that's exactly what happened to me. Had the production manager of this place say, no, we don't have the money. Had the administration person saying, you're making a massive mistake if you don't hire that person. And lo and behold.
Never know. It's a similar quote I got once told, like, be kind to everybody because you never know who's going to give you your next job.
Mm-hmm.
And the industry, everybody's on their own little, in their own little lockers, going at their own paces, progressing as they do. And I've hired somebody as a runner a couple of years ago. She's now my producer for something. Like, you never know in this industry who is going to be your next contact, work opportunity, friend. Like, it is so short-sighted to be unkind to people in our industry. It is way, way, way too small.
Well, in saying that as well, you gave me a job temporarily, Isla, when I was up in Auckland for a very short period of time. So that's the proof is in the pudding. Like, I think I hit you up randomly and said, oh, someone was telling me that you're looking for a production runner, an assistant for the role. So there we go. Yeah, it is true. Worked out for me.
To prove your point, I was the admin person at that time. So there you go.
Even more proof. There we go. Yeah, exactly. And do you think that's a skill that's often not taught to us in general, like, especially from industry? I know there was a bit of it touched on when we were at uni and things like that, but networking is such a major part of working in media that I don't think a lot of people realize that when then they get in.
Yeah, hugely. And also it really mirrors all the learning that I've been just as a person in the workforce, as a director, like, it affects every aspect. As a human, as a neighbor, like, it's really affecting every aspect of my life, that the more time you can spend improving your EQ, your listening, your respect, your ability to read a situation, or your ability to read what is actually being said to you by somebody. Because as we know, what people say isn't necessarily what they're, like, saying in their head or in their actions. If you can, in any way that you can strengthen those, they will be an investment in your future.
I love that. I'm curious. We've moved through a lot of your career. We've talked about how you've moved through scripted TV. You've done screenwriting. You've done shorts. You've done these big live event shows. Is there any particular moment for you that has stuck out and still sticks in your mind as being like, I can't believe I'm in this industry. I can't believe I'm here. Is there one particular moment that you look back on and you're like, wow, like.
After that whole period of, like, resting, recuperating, gallivanting around with a rucksack, I obviously had time to, like, think and process. And I was like, I think I've got it in me to give it another stab. I was like, you know, I'm mid-20s by this point. So I'm like, I'm still young. But what I need to do is focus into getting into the part of the industry that I have always wanted to work in, which is scripted drama. The, like, micro industries within our industry, although my career is, like, jumped around from doco to reality to this to that, that's really not typical. They sort of are very siloed. In New Zealand, they are very siloed. I don't know about overseas. And you sort of work that chain and you work your way up. And the same people do the same, like, it's the same people that do pretty much all the commercials in New Zealand. It's the same people who do all the sort of big scripted dramas, like, they're, yeah, little whirlpools, and you sort of stay in your whirlpool. And I had fuck all experience in the scripted drama whirlpool. So I, like, had a good think, and I was like, how do I transition over? And I don't want to work in production, because I love producing. I know that I have an aptitude towards it, but it wasn't getting me any closer towards my creative, desires and pursuits. And so I realized I couldn't work in production because I'd be stuck in the office, and I wanted to be on set. So then I thought, okay, which department am I most likely to be able to get my foot in the door? Is that, like, runner baby position? And there's a department called assistant directors, which only exists for the scripted industry. Doesn't exist for, like, any other, pretty much. And the assistant directors are, it's not a creative role in any way. It's logistical. You run the set. You're like mama bear, papa bear of the set. You run the schedule. You plan what's going to happen next. You're the liaison, the contact point between all the departments. And it's a whole, you know, hierarchy of people who are all ADs, because when the crew sizes start swelling to, you know, like a big film feature or anything, that we're talking about hundreds of people. And that's just the onsetters. Then there's the hundreds who are working behind the scenes as offsetters. Like, there's just an entire department dedicated to communication, organization, and like telling everybody what we're doing next. You also look after the cast when they're on set. And you run lots of timings and boss people around lots, basically. So it looked, from the outside, looked quite glamorous. And I was like, right, that's what I should go for. And then I spent like months like cold calling people, sending my CV, which had zero relevant experience on it, and like asking people for coffee. I was basically whoring myself out, getting nowhere. But the thing is, you can send 30 emails. You only need one to reply. You only need one to give you the job offer. And this really a wonderful, she's a director, but she started out as an AD. So at the time, she was a very well-known first. She sort of read, like, I think she saw a little bit of her in me. And she'd been given a chance by a female AD for her first job. And she like met me for coffee, and she just wanted to know what I was like as a person. Because again, it all comes down to attitude. She was like, yeah, I can teach you all the skills. I just want to know you're not going to be a pain to work with, and that you can follow instructions, etc. So she took a chance on me. And then that job sort of led to a next job, which led to a next job. And then suddenly like a couple of years had gone by, and I'd just been working my way up through the ranks of being an AD. And I did love that, because I had that whole pinchy moment that you talked about, where I remember being in a forest that had been built for a set. Like, I'm in a studio on a soundstage in an entire living, breathing forest with a campfire, with snow that has been man-made. And I was just like, I can't believe this is my office.
It's that surreal moment of realizing you've got to the point that you want to be at. Yeah, I love the fact that the assistant AD, the first AD that you're mentioning, really wanted to see you based off attitude. I think that's a really interesting point I've noticed with more and more people entering the industry, is people like people that they can just work with, that likability. It's not always down to just technical raw skills. It's actually, can I work with this person? Do I know I'm going to enjoy working with them? And I love that. Yeah, I think that's...
And you're in the trenches with these people. To continue the army analogy, which I use all the time, actually. Like, you are in the trenches with these people. When you, like, yell, like, we're going over the top, are they going to come with you into enemy fire? Because those are the people you want by your side.
And they're going to see you at your worst and see you at your best, and the same respect as well. They probably want your support when they need it. And, yeah, I love that. Because there's a lot of trust that's involved with it. And deviating a little bit. Yeah, so much trust. And deviating a little bit, this is the thing I found interesting over the last wee while, and please question it or debate it if you think otherwise. But in the past, in New Zealand, scripted TV was a lot done through like MediaWorks, and local networks were doing it. But now we're seeing streaming giants coming in like Amazon, Netflix, and other things like that. Do you feel that's adding benefit to the industry because now we're getting bigger productions, or how do you see TV work going forward? Is there more work coming through to New Zealand? Are we seeing more opportunities?
Tricky question to answer. For the crew, yes, there are more opportunities in that the bigger jobs hire more people. And for someone like my partner, pretty much exclusively works across the really big budget international jobs that come in. So that creates a huge amount of work for our industry. I think the tax rebate is wonderful because the amount of money that the productions also funnel into the economy, like my partner right now is in South Island shooting a TV series, and they have like, you know, they've booked out every bloody motel room in like a 50-kilometer radius in the area of the South Island that they're in. Like, you can't tell me that's not putting money into the local economy. The catering is sourced locally. The equipment is sourced locally. The materials, the labor. I definitely think, yeah, if you look at, was the strikes last year or the year before? When the big Hollywood actors strike happened, therefore there was no big international jobs happening in New Zealand for a good like 8 month stretch. And that really hurt us. There are so many people that I know who were out of work for the better part of a year. And like the domestic industry, obviously everyone then turned around and tried to get jobs on domestic things. But the domestic industry was only of a certain size and could only absorb so many people. Having said that, I do think that I do get frustrated that there's so many, I love all the shows that are coming here to shoot all these wonderful stories and using New Zealand backdrops, but the vast, vast majority of them, their world is not New Zealand. You know, their world is, we're doubling for America, we're doubling for somewhere in Asia, we're doubling for a fantasy world. And I do wish the streamers were also, like how Australia has that quota system to make sure that Netflix and the streamers are also investing in telling Australian stories on Australian soil. I do think we're missing a massive opportunity in that respect, but that I'm not the first person to have that thought. And there's, we obviously don't have as much leverage as Australia. We're a lot smaller. So that's a discussion I can see being had for, you know, with the powers that be, like the, you know, the big media giants in New Zealand. And I'm just a little voice sort of, yeah, just watching the discussion and hoping it goes a certain way.
It's funny you say that, because I kind of had the same thought when, and I only noticed this because of the fact that I love being able to show my partner, my country, and media from my country, films, TV, and everything else in between. And it's odd because on Netflix, Amazon here, there is a plethora of local content, which is odd because Argentina doesn't really have the money or funding and is not really now well known for producing a lot of content because it's too expensive to do it yet. But yet New Zealand, which technically is a pretty stable economy, pretty good like scene and everything else, not seeing as much local content out on the streaming giant. So I really hope that there is a change, and as you said, the powers that be make a difference. It's odd.
Our domestic budgets are being cut left, right, and center in terms of like New Zealand on Air's funding hasn't been increased in like aeons. And we all know what's happening with inflation. Like they've got more and more people competing for less and less money every round. Same exact, the film commission's getting completely gutted, like, or has already. Like, it's so competitive and so lean and so scarce. And obviously, there's always a silver lining. It means that, you know, the pitches are really competitive and there is some wonderful, you know, ideas and teams and people like really striving to rise to the top of that pile. But for instance, if you look at, the Labour government had this really wonderful initiative during the whole COVID debacle where they funded this sort of one-off couple of years fund called the Premium Fund. And it's where they gave much more money to projects than they ever usually would to like really boost the economy and the industry and to keep people tiding over with work during COVID. And there's been, I think it's three TV shows got funded through that, or maybe four. And don't quote me. People listening actually research it. But all I do know is I've had friends working on those productions and they have achieved remarkable success. They are objectively some of the best television shows that have come out of New Zealand in a long time. They are doing incredibly well overseas. They are selling into overseas markets. They are building New Zealand tourism and the art industry at large internationally. Like the return on investment, to use suit language, has been exponential. And I think it just proves beyond point, like when you actually put some money on the table, then we can start competing overseas with the stories that we're making. If you're giving us a penny for every pound that everybody overseas has got, we are never going to catch up. We are just going to become more and more redundant.
Do you think that's almost a scary thing? Because this was the thing I found funny when I had conversations with friends of mine who work in industry, obviously in the UK and other places, that I was saying we can't understand why New Zealand is not more a giant in the media space, considering how significant the last few decades of films have been in New Zealand. Like, I know friends of mine who can't even speak English and they know what Hunt for the Wilder People is, for example.
I know.
Which is odd to think about. It's probably more popular outside of New Zealand than it probably is in New Zealand, even though I know it was a massive film, but it's crazy to see that no one is taking a more drastic step to make sure that there is a future for, I know there is a future for the industry, but you know, a bigger step to make sure that the future is looking brighter for it.
And I'm not laying the blame as always. Every issue is always a compounding situation of multiple factors. And I am not laying the blame at any one doorstep. I also think that the funding bodies in New Zealand have their hands tied. They just got bugger all to hand around. Like, it's got to be a much more significant instrumental shift from a governmental, from a national level top down to like pour some blood into the industry before we can, so that we can actually invest, lay down some development pipelines. Good work takes time. It takes development of teams. It takes infrastructure. It takes years to turn around a single film, years and years. Like, there's no quick fix. And obviously we're not the only industry hurting at the moment with a national government that's cutting left, right, and center. Like, you know, I obviously am biased and I think that culture and arts deserve every penny that can go towards them. But I also think like our healthcare is being completely underfunded. Like there's obviously look at the political results in New Zealand at the moment. We're all very divided in terms of like cutting or spending to set.
That's very true. And it's funny because it's reflected the same here. The government over here actually recently did a massive cut when the new president came in, saying that arts and culture was not relevant to anything that was really happening. To the point
which
that
is just total bullshit.
It is. It's like, complete bullshit. Yeah, exactly. It's reflective of a whole... It's a reflective of a nation. It's reflective of the people. It's something I still struggle to deal with when anyone says arts and culture is not relevant and it's not needed. It's very much needed.
For people who like have that kind of thinking, I'm like, fantastic. Do a year without any stories. Turn off your Spotify. Cancel your Netflix. Don't go to the cinema. Don't go to theatre. Never attend a dance class. Never have music while you're going for a run or going to a gig. Like, do a year without art, and then come back to me and tell me if you still believe that.
I think that is a very valid point. And Isla, because I want to wrap up, because I feel like I've taken up too much of your time as it is, I would love to know, for anyone that's getting into industry, what would be your word of advice? We've talked about a lot of things. We've covered a lot of your time in the industry, tenacity being a big thing, networking, but what would be, in your mind, the biggest piece of advice you could give to someone who's entering, one, the industry now, and two, just getting into television?
I would not be quick to make judgments is what I would advise people starting out. Like, I'd try as many different departments as possible, ask people for coffee and, you know, gain advice from them. Say yes to every opportunity. Like, it's so different out there to what you expect looking in from the outside, that I'd just say, like, make sure, do your research. And because once you've figured out what you want to do or what you're interested in, it's going to take a lot of energy and time and literally, like, you know, money to pursue that. Just, yeah, make sure it's what you're really going to want.
If you like the podcast, I'd love for you to leave a 5-star review on your preferred podcast platform and let me know your thoughts on the show. Don't forget, you can reach out to me via Instagram at beyondbroadcastpod or via email at beyondbroadcastpod@gmail.com. Until next time, take it easy.